This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Paul Moore, the former Episcopal Bishop of New York, died yesterday at age 83 after suffering from brain and lung cancer. He was a longtime outspoken advocate for social change inside and outside the church. He pushed for the ordination of women and was the first bishop to ordain an openly lesbian priest. He fought for civil rights, opposed the war in Vietnam, sought aid for inner-city residents, and supported John Lennon's efforts to become a U.S. citizen. Moore was ordained in 1949 and gave his last sermon as bishop 40 years later. Although he worked tirelessly to help the poor, he came from a wealthy family. He grew up in a house in New Jersey staffed by butlers and maids, with a three-hole golf course just beyond the garden. Terry spoke with Paul Moore in 1997 and asked if he was ever conflicted over whether to keep his money or give it away.
My first wife and I worried about this, especially when we were living in Jersey City amongst many poor people who didn't have enough clothes and sometimes not enough to eat, and I could have written them a check for $100. But that would have been a very bad thing for the dynamics of the work we were doing. But what we decided to do was to live in a relatively modest fashion in Jersey City. We lived right there next to the church, very modestly. Then to give away whatever of our income was left after we spent what we needed to spend to charity of one kind or another. And then later on I took a big hunk of it and made a foundation which I could use anonymously to help other causes. And over the years I've given away a lot of the capital as well as the income, but not to the point of St. Francis. I did not strip down in the public square, and I still wear clothes.
Now, you said before that you could have written out a check to poor people for, you know, $100 to help them out, but that would have been bad for the dynamics of what you were trying to do. I want you to elaborate on that.
Well, that would have meant that they would be coming there for a handout, period. And we probably would have had 1,000 people at the door. And just giving out checks, that was not what we were about. But that had to do with the church and parish being the center of a community of love, God's love, human love, starting at the altar where we had our Eucharist each day and spreading out into the community in terms of ministering to poor people in their hardship, but also in trying to change the system and developing a network through the city as best we could by establishing cell groups in different neighborhoods, by getting to know the children and through them their parents, by encouraging rent strikes and so forth. Doing this in order to try to change the system. And if we had become just a handout place, first of all, we would have eventually had to set up guidelines and become just sort of a second-rate foundation, and that was not what we were there for. So my extra money that we had, I gave outside the parish to other causes within the church and in the world.
You said that religion wasn't an important part of your life until about the 11th grade. What religion were you born into?
Episcopal Church. My mother was a Presbyterian, actually, but she went to the Episcopal Church because my father went there. Then he quit. She continued. But she used to take me to church every Sunday. I didn't go to Sunday school. First time I went, they threw spitballs at me because I didn't know the kids. So I never went back. And I kept going every Sunday. It was very boring. And I used to look at the stained glass windows and fiddle with the prayer books. Went to St. Paul's School. It was still pretty boring, but a little nicer because it was an atmosphere of a school there, and the prayers were more youth-friendly.
Well, part of what changed you was your first confession.
That's right.
What made you decide to take this first, to give this first confession?
Well, there was a master on the faculty there who was a priest, and we were a so-called low-church school. However, he was very interested in what we used to call Anglo-Catholicism, which was the high church or Catholic part of our Episcopal heritage. And the Anglo-Catholic churches had incense, they had bells, people crossed themselves, people genuflected. It was a whole other thing. It was Catholicism. And he used to take us to high church ceremonies, which were rather mysterious and wonderful and beautiful. And as adolescents, we were drawn to that. And also the fact, he said, don't tell the rector of the school I took you because he wouldn't approve. So there was sort of sub rosa, which is also for a teenager very interesting. And then he talked about confession, which was always available in our church, but very little used. and encouraged us to do that. We were a little scared of the idea. So a monk came to school, and I was asked to go see him, which I did, and talk to him about why should I confess to a man when I could confess directly to God. And he said, well, of course you can confess to God directly, but when you make your confession, it's a sacrament. It's a deeper kind of assurance of forgiveness. So looking back was sort of funny, but at the time was very embarrassing, naturally, and I made my confession to him later that night with clammy hands and shaking fingers. And when he pronounced the absolution, as his priest, I absolve you from all your sins in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost, I was overwhelmed by a presence of God, by a sense of peace and joy and wonder. I can't describe it. And walked home to my room in the clouds and made my communion the next day, and it was as if I'd received the sacrament for the first time. And that was a turning point in my life.
And did you stay with the Anglican Church?
Oh, yes.
After that? You know, you became a Marine and fought in World War II shortly after your conversion experience. And your conversion experience transformed you, but I'm sure the war did too. Did you feel at all like it was changing you in a different direction, away from the like open-heartedness that you wanted to have as a convert, as a new convert?
Well, yes and no. I think first of all, I had some questions about whether a Christian should go to war. But my rector had been in World War I, had been gassed, was a wonderful and very devout man. I respected him enormously, and he felt, as I did then, that it was the lesser of two evils, that Hitler and, because the Japan wasn't in it then, but Nazism, if that took over the world, beginning with Europe, that it would be a total disaster for the church and for civilization, and that this is one of the few times where it was justified to fight, a just war, if you will. So I went in, and once I decided to go in, I gobbled up the Marine Corps hook, line, and sinker, Semper Fidelis, rough, tough, leatherneck. We had bayonet training where we had to scream and yell and stick our bayonets into straw dummies and knock heads off dummies, heads that were dressed up to look like Japanese oriental heads. It was absolutely terrible. But this process was a toughening up of our psyche. I was a young, callow kid from Yale. I had to be toughened to go through the stuff we would go through. And so the training was necessary. But it made us impervious to some of the horrors that we were asked to do. I shot one man I know without any need to have shot him, just because he was lying there. And I just shot him. And this happened again and again and again. But so we had to have been toughened. But at the same time, it did make me realize that my faith was strong enough to get me through that kind of horror and come out on the other side.
You were hit by a grenade during the war, and it punctured a lung.
Actually, I was throwing a grenade.
It was your own grenade that blew up.
I threw a grenade at a machine gun nest, which was killing some of our men, and as I knelt upright to throw it, I got hit by the machine gun I was throwing the grenade at. So I was hit by a bullet, went through my chest, past my heart. The doctors thought it should have hit the heart, but they figured the heart was on the inbeat when the bullet went by. So I was very lucky, to put it mildly.
But at the time, you thought you were dying. And you write
at the time,
that,
I thought I was dying.
And you write that this near-death experience wasn't a spiritual experience at all. What were you expecting, and how did it compare?
Well, I wasn't expecting anything. I hadn't really thought much about it. Death was all around us. We were getting quite casual about death. I remember running out under fire to get a package of cigarettes. I risked my life to get a package of cigarettes. My friends had been killed. My man I'd seen bleeding in my arms. And death became so common. It's hard to believe that when I finally got hit, so I got hit this time, and I lay down after this bullet went in. The wind was going in and out of, blubbering in and out of this wound in my lung, and I thought I was dying. I gave over the platoon to the sergeant, and then I fainted. But before I fainted, I thought, well, I'm supposed to remember my whole life. That didn't happen. Then I said, I better say a prayer, which I said a prayer commending myself to God. But it wasn't a deep business of seeing Jesus coming to get me or anything like that. It was sort of almost casual. Now, if I had died, I don't know whether it would have been that casual or whether it would have been a much deeper experience. I presume it would have been. But if I died going back to the aid station on that stretcher when I was already unconscious, what I just recounted would have been my experience of death, at least the conscious part of dying. And whether something else opens up after you lose consciousness, if you are dying, is one of the great mysteries.
Because you're a bishop in the Anglican Church and not the Roman Catholic Church, mm-hmm. you were able to marry and have children. Celibacy yeah. is not required of priests in the Anglican Church. Do you think you could have been a celibate priest, or is that something? Do you disagree with the concept that you need to?
I disagree totally with that concept. Mm-hmm. There are some priests who are drawn to the celibate life. We have celibates in our church. We have monks who are celibate by vow, and we have secular priests who have not gotten married for whatever reason and are celibate. But that wasn't for me. I mean, I wanted to have children. I'd fallen in love before I went to the seminary. I was married before I became a priest. And I feel very deeply that my marriage and experience in my family, not only the joys of it, but some of the pain and sorrow of family life gave me, and the difficulty of marriage gave me an understanding in counseling people who were having marital problems and family problems that I never could have had as a single priest. And this isn't putting down celibacy for those who want it.
You were a father during those difficult-to-be-a-parent times of the 1960s. I think some of your children were teenagers during the 60s.
Indeed, they were.
All the sexual standards of the past are being challenged by young people. And you write in your book that you wanted to give your children as much freedom as possible, although you forbade drugs with whatever power you had to do that. But that, you know, you believe the culture suffered from too much sexual puritanism. So when your children were coming of age, how did you deal with issues of their sexuality and of how they could deal with boyfriends and girlfriends in the house?
Well, that was tough. I mean, we started by being very much against anybody having intercourse until they were married. And then the next step is, as we were exposed to the liberal thinking of the 60s, which you just described, we began to think this was a little bit too tight, and my wife would teach my teenage daughters about birth control so that if they did have intercourse, they would be safe. This is long before AIDS, of course. As far as the dope goes, we are vigorously against hard drugs of any kind, but we were a little loose about marijuana. I remember going upstairs, my 15-year-old was suddenly interested in growing plants in a window box, and I thought, isn't this nice? And I looked up, and of course, the plants were marijuana.
Right.
So we went through that kind of thing. But you just struggle through. We were making ad hoc decisions in the midst of the event. We didn't have a hard ideology we insisted on, and I'm sort of glad we didn't. I think, looking back, I think we did okay. I might have made some changes in retrospect.
You supported the ordination of women in your church, and you were the first bishop to ordain a lesbian priest within the church. How did you come around to that thinking? You didn't always support the ordination of women or gays.
Well, I think one of the reasons I came around so quickly to the ordination of women is I had six daughters and a wife.
Were they pushing you?
Indeed, they were. I remember one time when we were up in the Adirondacks, I said, "Girls, why don't you clear the table?" "Girls? Why should the girls clear the table?" So, you know, that taught me one lesson.
All right.
And, well, the whole ethos, the women's movement was very much part of their thinking and my wife's thinking and my thinking, and it wasn't long before I realized it was just absolutely ridiculous not to allow women to be priests. Historically, although theology says that God is beyond gender, neither man nor woman, historically God has been looked at as a father figure, as a male figure, as a God of judgment. And I think the Roman Catholic Church has sort of made up for that by their cult of the Virgin. But in our church, the Virgin Mary didn't have much of a role. And therefore, I think our people were starved for a femininity in their devotion. And so when women became priests and you could hear a woman's voice reading the Bible, a woman's voice celebrating the Eucharist, you gradually realized that Jesus Christ took on human flesh, happened to be a man, but he took on all human flesh, and that God made us in his image, both man and woman, and that's in the Bible. But that was a very deep reason to have women priests, as well as the obvious reason of its being discriminatory not to.
What about gays and lesbians?
Gays and lesbians, again, what happened to me was that a gay woman who was out of the closet, as it were, she'd written articles for a gay magazine, came to see me, wanted to be a priest. She was totally qualified, brilliant academically, and a fine person. But she was out of the closet. And I said, no way could we ordain you. And the standing committee, who had to okay, too, I wouldn't even think of it. I floated by them. They said half of them would resign if I did this. So I said, no. She said, well, I'm going to go to seminary anyway. I said, well, feel free. So she came back 3 years later and asked again. By that time, a lot had happened. Women were beginning to be ordained. And so it was possible. And I thought to myself, over those 3 years, the only difference between Ellen Barrett, her name, and maybe 20% of our clergy who are gay and in the closet is she is more open, more honest. Not that they didn't have a right to be private, but she also had a right, it seemed to me, to be open. So I headed one of my chapters, my last book, about this issue. Is honesty a bar to ordination? And I couldn't answer yes. So I said, okay, Ellen, we'll try it. The standing committee reluctantly went along. We ordained Ellen, and all hell broke loose. Later on, some of the parishes refused to pay their dues to the diocese. I had hearings when I was repudiated. It was all over the papers. I had special secretary to answer the mail, and I finally, there was an attempt to censure me in the House of Bishops. So it was an enormous explosion. People say, you're so courageous. I said, it's like being courageous to say you're courageous when you're standing in the middle of the road and get hit by a truck.
Any regrets?
No, but I'm not sure I would have been as courageous as I was if I'd known what was going to happen. I hope I would have been.
I'd like to take you back to 1949, which was your first Christmas as an ordained priest. In fact, I think it was your first Eucharist.
You're right.
Would you share some of your memories of that first Eucharist in 1949?
Well, it was in Jersey City, and it was a wonderful moment for me. The congregation was already integrated. A lot of the boys we'd begun to reach had become acolytes. And to be able to stand at the altar, especially in that inner city situation, and realize you were celebrating the Eucharist for Christmas when our Lord became a poor child and changed, redeemed the whole life of human beings by that becoming man, becoming human. And the other thing that was so strange was that Christmas was a very cruel time for many of our people because they couldn't afford to buy presents for their children. We had attempted suicides. We had murders. We had alcoholism. Whenever Christmas came, it was a time of horror stories as well as a time of beauty. And so I've always remembered that. And if only people understood, especially poor people understood, that the message of Christmas was that God became poor, then perhaps they wouldn't have this awful tension between the materialistic Christmas and advertisements and the little they're able to do to their own families. So there was always this tension, as there was in the original Christmas, a homeless woman having an illegitimate child in a stable, and our image of all the lovely carols and golden Christmases that we have.
Paul Moore speaking with Terry Gross. She spoke with him shortly before Christmas in 1997. Moore, the former Episcopal Bishop of New York, died yesterday at age 83. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.